Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want positivity, hope, and examples of how to improve society. We're not blaming and we're not finger pointing here. I'm DJ EJ, and I'm with my co-host Habanero.
Good morning.
Our guest today is April Burgess Johnson. She's the executive director of Helpmate, which provides safety, shelter, and support for victims/survivors of intimate partner domestic violence. But first, it's National Lookalike Day. So somewhere out there is someone who probably looks like you. And I guess we should also just give a nod to the fake pictures that have been floating around that we should all be concerned about. But for most people, perhaps more importantly, it's April 20th, 420 Day. And
oh boy.
If you're listening, I think you probably know what that means. So enjoy yourself today. Check out all of our podcasts of this show, blog, and video insights at underaffiliated.com. And be sure to stream Asheville FM live from the site or the app all day, every day. How's it going, April?
It's going well. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and Helpmate.
Sure. So I've been doing domestic violence work for about 30 years. I spent the last decade at Helpmate. And it's truly been one of the highlights of my career. I've gotten to see a lot of incredible community change over the past decade, and it's been really meaningful for survivors in our community. So Helpmate's existed for nearly 50 years. We're one of the oldest domestic violence programs on the eastern coast of of the United States. And as you mentioned, we provide safety, shelter, and support to survivors of domestic violence. And what that looks like is we have a 24-hour emergency hotline that folks can call any time of the day or night to get support that if they're experiencing domestic violence, if they think they might be, if they have a friend or a family member that's in an abusive relationship and they want to know how to support that person. You can call us anytime and we can talk through that situation.
I'm going to want to give the number out a few times during the program. So if you can just let people know that number to call.
Absolutely. Our number is 828-254-0516. And that's a 24-hour per day number. And when we're on the phone with survivors, one of the things that we do is we try to help people assess their individual risks. We use a tool called the Danger Assessment to help with that. And it helps us both understand what the survivor's situation looks like, what their specific risks are, but it also gives us an indicator of homicide and lethality risk so that we can really literally begin the process of saving lives with survivors.
So what are some of the components of that risk?
So some of the things that feed into risk for survivors of domestic violence, if a partner threatens to kill you, then they're more likely to actually do that than folks who don't. And then the presence of a lethal weapon, usually a firearm, in the household makes it 7 times more likely that a survivor will be killed by their partner. If there's a victim that has a child that's not biologically related to their abusive partner, then not only is that adult victim more at risk, but so is that child. And the last thing that I'll mention is if a survivor has ever been choked by their partner, strangled by their partner, then there's two kind of risks associated there. One, that survivor is more likely to be killed by their partner. And two, that partner is more likely to engage in community violence as well. So it's a place where that violence in the home really spills out and becomes a danger to the broader society.
So when you think about what you just described, are there a lot of cases that you're dealing with?
So in our community, Helpmate served 3,660 survivors just last year. That means that we're serving more survivors per capita than any other domestic violence program in the state of North Carolina. And I really do believe that's not just about rates of domestic violence in Buncombe County. I don't know that we are a more violent county than anywhere else. I think we're doing a good job of reaching survivors, building some confidence in services, and funneling survivors quickly to services. But it's important to know this is a prevalent problem across the United States. The Centers for Disease Control tells us that 1/3 of all women a tenth of all men and half of transgender people will experience domestic violence at some point in their lives.
So could you go into a little bit more detail about the socioeconomics and the demographics of folks? Are there even more specific groups and numbers of people who are more likely to be abused?
So domestic violence really occurs across the spectrum. So people of all socioeconomic classes, religions, backgrounds, demographics, we see survivors literally from all walks of life. One of the things that we will see is that with domestic violence and other types of violence as well, communities of color bear a higher burden of that violence. And that's rooted in a few different things, one of which is historically difficult relationships with law enforcement and helping professionals. And so we see that black victims of domestic violence are twice as likely to be killed by their partners. So while Buncombe County is only comprised of 11% people of color, Helpmate's emergency shelter population is 41% people of color. And we really do have a strong commitment to making sure that we're reaching all segments of our community so that folks feel safe coming forward to get help, because we don't want to see those national homicide rates replicated here in our community.
For folks who are concerned for themselves, and even just for everyone else's education, is there a progression from warning signs to actual violence to actual I've got to get to a shelter?
Absolutely. And, you know, violence, the broad thing that I'll say about that is that violence gets more frequent and more severe over time. And so it becomes kind of a downward spiral for folks, where there'll be kind of an incident of violence, things will feel better for a minute, and there'll be more violence. But even in that time when things kind of feel better for a minute, you're not going back to the way things were when that relationship first began. So early on in a relationship, you'll see things like extreme jealousy or unrealistic expectations about the roles of each partner in a relationship. You'll see kind of frequent mood changes, almost a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde kind of setup. And then as time goes on, you'll see that escalate into more control over a survivor. Instead of just saying, I don't think you can do that, or I don't think you should do that, instead saying, you may not do that. And then over time, violence will be used to solidify those commands that a batterer is given.
So you mentioned that abuse can, I think people have a stereotype that it's more likely to be men, but you said that in some cases it is women who are delivering the abuse. Can you describe the characteristics between the genders? Like, how would you compare them in terms of actually being domestically violent?
Sure. And so, you know, looking at those national statistics and also Helpmate's local statistics, somewhere between 80 and 95% of domestic violence survivors are women. Mm-hmm. Somewhere between 80 and 95% of perpetrators are male. So that means that somewhere between 5 and 20% of those perpetrators are female. And so we do see some gender differences in types of violence that are used. Men are more likely to use lethal violence, and they're more likely to use physical violence. Women are a lot more likely to use manipulation and emotional violence to control their partners.
Of the services you provide, which ones would you say that you're using the most?
So our emergency hotline that I mentioned earlier, that's kind of the gateway into all of Helpmate services. Another service that I'll call out is our court advocacy service. And so Helpmate has an office inside the Buncombe County Courthouse, and we work with survivors who are doing one of two things. We support folks who are applying for a domestic violence protective order. That's a specialized type of restraining order that's designed to protect a survivor from their abusive partner by telling that abusive partner they need to stay away. And then we also serve survivors who are acting as a state's witness for a crime that was committed against them. So we're working closely with the district attorney's office in that way as they move forward to prosecute those crimes. And I'll just say that we've seen some dramatic impacts of the COVID pandemic on survivors. And one of the most notable is in our criminal court cases. We served within a 2-year period the number of criminal cases that we served in Buncombe County courts went up by 40%. That's a huge increase in such a short period of time. And it really does kind of lay bare the difference in depth of violence. We've not just seen more people being abused, we've seen a dramatic increase in how severe that abuse is and how traumatized the survivors who've experienced it are. And that that court increase is kind of the canary in the coal mine that really sent up a red flag that we were starting to see a flood of a different kind of need.
So it sounds like COVID accelerated the spiral you're talking about. So in other words, if it's you don't have COVID and you can leave the house for a while and do your thing every day, that can make the pressure cooker less intense. But when you're confined, it can crank it up. How can someone look at their situation and get to a point where it's like, this is just going to get worse? Because you said there's a tendency for it to get worse. So the question is, what are the things where someone can say, it's not going to get better?
And I think that varies a lot from person to person and relationship to relationship. You know, no two people are the same. No two experiences of domestic violence are the same. Clearly, when that physical violence escalates, when you find yourself isolated to the point that you can't regularly be in contact with your friends, your family, your support system, then that's a clear indicator that that batterer's manipulation has made them the sole focus of your time, energy, and attention. And when that's the case, it's a real warning sign that they could escalate with impunity, because the people who typically love you won't know that because you're not in contact with them.
Right. Can you describe how victims, survivors feel emotionally by the time they get to you?
That's a good question. We see kind of a mix of feelings. Mostly it's hurt, not just physically hurt, but emotionally grappling with the question of, how could somebody who promised to love, protect, and cherish me instead use violence to manipulate, control and punish me, right? And so we see a lot of trauma and hurt. We see some folks who are angry, because of course you would be angry because somebody's treated you in a way that you didn't deserve. And then over all of that, I would say fear. Fear about whether they're going to be stalked and hurt, because we know that a survivor is 75% more likely to be seriously hurt or killed after they've left or while they're in the process of leaving, which is why it's important to take those steps carefully and with a safety plan. And then we see fears about things like, how am I going to get diapers for the baby? Where are we going to live? You know, maybe my partner had our only car. How am I going to get to the places that I need to go to? And that can be a terrifying experience. And so Helpmate has a team of case managers who are specialized in helping survivors find the resources they need to answer some of those practical questions.
So I could see a situation where there's a feeling of, I've got to get out, I'm out. What's the first step then that you would recommend for someone once they're out? Because there's so many things that it sounds like goes through their brains, and anything from figuring out how you're going to live to a restraining order because they're afraid. What are typically the first 2 to 3 things that come to mind?
So I'd say the first thing really is to contact Helpmate, or if you're in another county, contact your local domestic violence service provider so that you can form a safety plan. Safety plans are both short and intermediate term plans about what you're going to do to keep yourself safe in various types of situations. I'll give you an example. If you ever notice when law enforcement cars are parked, they back into a parking place. The reason that they back into a parking place is when there's an emergency, it's easier to leave more quickly if you're driving forward than if you're driving backwards. And so we talk to survivors about some practical things like, hey, do you have a long driveway and you live at the top of the hill? How about you back up that driveway so that if you need to leave, you can do so quickly? Packing a go bag that has things like your medications, your children's important items, some documents that you might need. And so, you know, if you have to flee, where are you going to go? Do you have a friend or a family member that would be safe for you to stay with? Do you need to come into Helpmate's emergency shelter? And so those are some of the things that we really think through with survivors in forming that safety plan.
Can you tell us a little bit about the psychology behind both the perpetrator and the victim? How do they get into a situation where there's this cycle of fear, manipulation, violence? How does that even start?
So talking about domestic violence offenders, about the batterers in these relationships, we see some patterns over the course of their lifetime. So one of the things that we see pretty consistently is that a person who's experienced domestic violence as a child, typically by witnessing domestic violence where one parent perpetrated against the other parent, that child is four times as likely to experience domestic violence as an adult, either because they've perpetrated it or because they themselves become a victim. When one of their child's parents was hospitalized or incarcerated, then that number goes up to 100 times more likely. And we see a gender differential there that girls who witness domestic violence as children are more likely to experience domestic violence as an adult victim. And boys who witness domestic violence as a child are more likely to grow up and perpetrate it as adults. And that really tells me very clearly we can't give up on our children, especially our sons. It's not a foregone conclusion that they're going to grow up and batter, right? That we need to intervene quickly and swiftly with families where there's domestic violence. We need to wrap services around those children so that those unhealthy patterns don't continue into adulthood. If they have, then one of the things that we see that's very common among adult domestic violence offenders is a lack of empathy. And so the process to try to undo some of that is to try to build empathy among those offenders, first for themselves as a child, right? If they've had this experience, to be able to recognize that, to forgive themselves, because even though children don't deserve to hold guilt about what they've experienced or witnessed, sometimes they do. The second step is, if they're a parent, to really try to build empathy for their own child. And then the third step is to try to build empathy for that adult survivor with whom they were partnered.
It makes sense. If you're a witness to domestic violence, it is something that could carry forward throughout your own life. Are there certain characteristics to begin with, not necessarily even in a person, that make a household more likely to have a violent offender in it?
There are characteristics of people who are more likely to be violent. So folks who are morbidly jealous, who have a sense of entitlement, they feel like the world owes them something and that their partner and their family should take care of them. People who have very rigid gender roles, I'm the man of the household, I'm the king of the castle, I wear the pants in this family. Those kind of things are very toxic displays of masculinity that are precursors sometimes to violence. Somebody who uses and has access to lethal weapons increases the danger in that household, but also increases propensity to use violence to begin with. And then somebody who has a disallowance of their partner's autonomy, right? So they can't recognize their partner as a co-equal adult that has the ability to and the right to self-determination. When those things start to show up in a relationship, then the likelihood that that partner is going to become abusive goes way up.
Do you think, or let me put it this way, to what degree is this learned behavior like you're talking about, experienced it, versus natural? That's how you came out. You're just predisposed to this. You're, you know, nature, nurture.
Batterers are not born, they're built.
One of the things that not only did you mention, but I know I've noticed, is that a lot of times these situations involve very small children. Is there some kind of a trigger that a new family member or a new child into the family, even if it's the abuser's child, does that change the dynamic in a triggering way?
It really does. So we see pregnant people experiencing physical violence at a rate 3 times as high as before they became pregnant. And it really has to do with the power and control dynamic that a batterer creates in this relationship, right? So a domestic violence relationship centers around one person's desire to gain and maintain a system of power and control and dominance over their partner and over other people in their family. And that system of power and control and dominance, it meets that batterer's needs at the expense or the exclusion of the needs of other people in that family. And so when the survivor becomes pregnant, then that pregnant person's focus should and does change to taking care of their own body, taking care of the baby that they're trying to grow and birth. And a batterer will sometimes react in pretty extreme ways to that loss of attention, focus, and control. And so we see violence escalate during and immediately after pregnancy.
So actually beating a pregnant woman.
Yes, and more likely to beat a pregnant woman than a non-pregnant woman.
So I'm going to shift gears a little bit. And we talked about, this seems like there's a big need for this, obviously. And with big needs comes a price tag. So tell us a little bit about funding, how that's going. Are we recognizing it enough? Do we need more funding? Tell us a little bit about all that.
I'm grateful for that question. It has been a difficult time for HelpMate and organizations like ours across the United States. Several years ago, there was a change in federal policy that impacted the way that the National Crime Victims Fund received fines that were paid through criminal fees and penalties from federal crime prosecutions. And that Crime Victims Fund is the largest source of funding for victim services programs in the United States. And so once there were less fees and penalties being paid into that fund, the amount of federal funding available to local programs that serve domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking survivors dwindled to an all-time low. And I'll just give you some numbers to illustrate. In 2018, the state of North Carolina had $108 million to distribute to domestic violence, sexual assault programs across the state. This year, they had $21 million. That's enough to decimate a continuum of services in the state. And so we've been very fortunate here in Buncombe County that there are people who have risen up to continue to support HelpMate. This funding constriction, there's been a federal fix put into place. But because these funds are doled out over time and in 5-year cycles, it's going to be another 2 to 3 years before we really start to see that fund plump back up and get distributed out to local programs. And so right now is a very critical time to support your local victim services programs.
You use the term Crime Victims Fund, which is not specific to domestic violence. Did you mean specifically for domestic violence?
The Crime Victims Fund is what is used to distribute money through the Victims of Crime Act. Okay. And so it's all types of victim services across the U.S.
Okay. So it feels like this was just a budget cutting kind of thing, saying we're giving too much funding for crime victims.
It was actually about a change in federal prosecution strategy. There became a movement towards more deferred prosecutions. And so people who were accused of those crimes would pay fees and penalties, but not ever be convicted of the crime, right? Because it was deferred prosecution. They would make some amends. And there was no clarity about when they paid a penalty before a conviction, did it actually go into the Crime Victims Fund? Now it's clear that it does. But for some time, it wasn't. And so that fund just dwindled down.
So let's move back to some of the aspects of domestic violence. In your work, what are some of the most frustrating things about domestic violence that you see where you're just like, this seems like an easy fix. Why is this still going on? Like,
yeah,
fed up with.
Lack of community recognition about the depth of the problem. We know that in the year prior to their death, only 4% of domestic violence homicide victims came to a program like HelpMate. That means that the 96% who did were safer because they did, right? So we know that there's a tremendous life-saving capacity to domestic violence victim service and advocacy programs. But in the year prior to their death, 44% of survivors had interaction with medical providers, which means that if we had things like universal screening in medical settings that funneled survivors over to domestic violence programs, our ability to prevent domestic violence homicides would go way up. If our court system was easier to navigate for survivors, if they were able to more easily get access to protective orders at any time of the day or night, those things would protect domestic violence survivors. I am proud of one thing that we're doing here in Buncombe County, and I think we're doing it better than a lot of places. We've implemented this protocol with law enforcement, where when local law enforcement respond to one of the 7,000 or so domestic violence response calls they get every single year, they ask a series of 11 questions that come out of that evidence-based danger assessment I mentioned earlier. And that predicts whether this victim is more or less likely to experience homicide if we don't intervene. And they're connecting survivors with Helpmate's hotline right there from the crime scene. And so really from that first moment, we're able to do some early intervention. Nationally, when a domestic violence survivor first connects with a local domestic violence program through that lethality assessment protocol, which is what that protocol is called, about 30% of them follow up for additional services. Here in Buncombe County, that number is 72%. And that really highlights the effectiveness of how law enforcement are communicating the value of those services and how survivors see that help might be available and trust those helping providers.
If that's happening in the moment, you have, as a survivor, you have less of a chance to forget and be convinced that, oh, wait, maybe that was just a blip. Everything's going to be okay. He was nice to me this morning.
Right.
You literally, I know you can literally have a mind change on that because your brain gets rewired somehow.
It does. Well, and batterers are manipulative by nature, right? If we go out on that first date and we're sitting across the table from one another and that batterer just reach out and smacks the food right out of your mouth, well, you're not likely to go out on a second date with them, right? That is not how abusive relationships start. They start with a caretaking, caring, kind kind of approach, and they devolve slowly into this violence over time. And so it's a very strong tool in that batterer's toolbox to hearken back to that time when we were in love and things were happy, and I'm going to be that person that you know.
And right? By that time, the batterer has learned what are the personalized triggers for that particular woman. I'm just going to use the gendering because that's what it seems to be. But what is it that makes her feel best, or what is it that makes her feel most insecure?
Absolutely. And this is the time when we see a lot of promises get made, right? I'm going to get a better job. I'm going to be a better partner. I'm going to be a better parent. I'm going to go to church or practice whatever faith is important to you. We're going to go to couples counseling, which is a terrible idea for couples where there's domestic violence. Each person getting counseling, great idea. Counseling together is a terrible idea because it assumes an equal playing field. You know, for counseling to work, you have to be able to say anything in that counseling environment. Well, you can't really do that if you're afraid you're going to be punished for what you said when you go home.
Are counselors specifically trained to identify those types of situations to be able to say, maybe we should be seeing you guys separately?
Yeah, that's a good question. And for the most part, yes. But we still occasionally see this come up where counselors are trying to offer couples counseling, either because they're unaware of the domestic violence dynamics, which can be understandable because it's often a hidden thing, or because they just don't know any better, which is scary and troubling. Helpmate has a team of licensed counselors that provide free individual trauma-informed counseling to survivors. And when folks have finished their kind of course of counseling with us, we're able to refer them out to community providers that we know are trauma-informed in their approach. Because when you have a counselor that doesn't understand trauma, you can actually deepen that traumatic experience and make the violence worse.
If people were to call you, are you able to help refer them to those types of counselors that have more of that? Or do people have to be in your program to be able to get those kinds of referrals?
Absolutely. People can call us for that. And again, I'll say our 24-hour domestic violence hotline number is 828-254-0516.
You mentioned just a minute ago that there's a lack of recognition about the depth of the problem. Is that because it's not talked about, it's promoted, people don't want to hear about it, denial?
It's all of those things, right? It's not, it's not great dinner table conversation to talk about how partners control, one partner controls another, how violence happens, how it impacts children. But it is really important because, again, we're talking about a third of all women, a tenth of all men, and half of all transgender people, which means there's not a human being in the United States that does not know a domestic violence survivor. You may not be aware that you know them. You may not be aware that they're surviving. But that means that it's beholden on each one of us to know what our local resources are and what to say to a survivor who needs help. And one of the things that you can start with is, I believe you. I believe what you're telling me. Because abuse sounds outlandish. We don't want to believe that human beings have the capacity for violence that they actually do. And so survivors are often disbelieved. So saying, I believe you, you don't deserve this, and I know who can help you, and I'm happy to sit with you while you call them or give you their phone number or take you to get services. Those are three very tangible, easy things that any human could do to support a survivor.
So that leads to another question I have, which is this issue of restraining orders. Because you're saying, I believe you, is the first thing you can do to help someone. And then my understanding is it's not exactly easy to get a restraining order. Why is that? What's the holdup? What would you change?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to be able to get a domestic violence protective order is a two-step process, typically. You go to the courthouse. Helpmate does have advocates there that can help you find the right paperwork and know where to go and who to talk to. You file an initial emergency order where the survivor meets with the judge, kind of pleads their case, and the judge offers that initial order called an ex parte order, and that means the other party wasn't present. And because the other party wasn't present, that order is offered just for a short period of time. Then there's a hearing set. Both parties show up. So you actually do have to be in the same courtroom with your abuser. And so Helpmate provides support through that process as well. And at that point, the order could be entered for up to a year, and it's renewable after that. Two of the things that could happen that would make that a little bit easier. One is, right now, there's just two filing times per day that you have to be at the courthouse during a specific window of time to be able to get an appointment in front of that judge. If we could broaden that and allow all-day filing, that would make it a lot more accessible, kind of obviously, I guess, for survivors to be able to get these domestic violence protective orders. The second thing is that sometimes survivors have a hard time getting to where they need to be, and that experience of facing the batterer can be overwhelming. And so allowing for remote court options where maybe a survivor could go to a different central location and have those hearings over video conference. And there's some cases pending right now about whether or not that video conferencing is allowable or not, because you're not actually facing your accuser.
So we have Zoom, and we can pay taxes online, but we can't keep women safe with our modern technologies. Could you repeat your number for anybody who needs to hear it?
Sure. Helpmate's 24-hour hotline is 828-254-0516.
What are some of the other solutions or actions that people can take, whether it's people or policy or the media can take to benefit the lives of people who are victims and survivors?
One of the things that I'd really encourage is volunteering. People get nervous sometimes about volunteering with a victim services program because they don't feel like they're going to know what to say to somebody. Well, the good news is that we provide really comprehensive training for folks who are volunteer advocates, and there's more than one opportunity. Of course, folks can help with answering our hotline. There's always a staff member there present as a backup. But people can also provide child care for survivors who are living in our shelter who need to do things like go to job interviews or attend a support group. They can provide child care during those support groups so that all of the parents can attend. You know, think about your house and all the chores and things you have to do at your house. You have to cut your grass and clean your sink. And we have to do all of those things at our shelter, too. And so folks that can help us with those basic maintenance kind of tasks, people who can do some record keeping and filing for us, people who can go out and speak in the community about domestic violence and how to get help if you're a survivor. Survivors who are willing to speak in the community about their experience and how they got help. Those are all things that folks can do on a volunteer basis to help take care of their neighbors who may be experiencing domestic violence. The other thing that you can do is donate. You know, we talked about the federal funding constriction. Donate to your local domestic violence program because now they need it more than ever. And HelpMate's website is helpmateonline.org, and folks can make a quick and easy donation there, either a one-time or a recurring donation. The third thing that I'll say is vote. And before you vote, know your candidate's stance on these issues. Ask the question, how do you intend to address domestic violence if you are elected? And use that to inform your vote.
What could anyone who is running for any office say other than, of course I support domestic violence? Or they can, I mean, would anybody literally sit there and say, it's a waste of time and money and I don't support it?
Sadly, yes.
Okay, so then that is an easy question to ask people. Okay.
It is. But, you know, I think you're right that it's easy for candidates to say domestic violence is bad and we must eradicate it. Great. I'm glad that you're philosophically on our team. My follow-up to that is how? Okay. What will you do in your role? And then listen for an answer that makes sense.
What would an answer look like?
It depends on the office. So one of the things right now that's pending in the North Carolina legislature is right now in North Carolina, if you want to file for a divorce, you file for divorce and you wait a year before you can actually be eligible to get that divorce. And the idea is that sometimes people get in a fight and they make a rash decision and we want, right? And we want to give people time to make up. So that's fine, I guess, when there's not domestic violence. But that means that a victim is forced to continue to be married to a person who's abused them for an extra year. And so there's a bill pending to try to reduce the amount of wait time for a domestic violence survivor to be able to get a divorce. That's an example of a good, very specific policy that our lawmakers are working to put into place to benefit survivors.
Women are the ones who file for divorce and then are faced with this year-long issue. It's not like guys are abusing women and then filing for divorce and waiting a year. It's usually women who are filing. I'm asking the question. Is that correct?
Yeah, because domestic violence impacts more women than it does men, that's true, that it's usually the survivor who is filing for the divorce and then having to wait a year to be able to get it. But even if the batterer says, you know what, I'm done with you, I want to be out of this, they can't because they have to wait for a year.
So that adds to the frustration.
Well, indeed. It's just fascinating. We talk about all this freedom that we want, and then there's this exception, which is dangerous for folks. If I just want to leave the house where I'm getting abused, I can't. I have to wait a year. I don't understand things like that. What can men do?
Men can hold other men accountable. So when there's somebody in your friendship group that is talking about, when they use ownership terms to talk about their partner, right? When they talk about my woman. When they put down their partner, when they talk about ways that they're going to control their partner, when they talk about their children as property that they have a right to versus a human that they have a responsibility to. then you can step up and be not just a bystander, but an upstander, and say, you know, hey, man, don't talk about your partner like that. She's good to you. And offer some of that community-based accountability, which research tells us is actually more effective than criminal justice accountability. And so every man in this country has more power than our court system does to undo domestic violence simply by speaking up when they see something troubling. The other thing you can do is set a good example for how to be a kind, safe, gentle, and loving man, and be vocal about why you're about how you're setting that example.
I just don't think that can be stressed enough. I almost want to hear a couple other examples of things that men can do actively to help be supportive of other men, to maybe recognize that what they're doing is not okay, and it's not kind of, I don't want to say acceptable, but I think it's so much easier to sit there and say, oh, that's just how Joe is, or, oh boy, here he goes again, or accepting of it without having that courage to step up and even make a small comment. I would like some more suggestions about how men might do that and in what kinds of situations.
And you're right that it's about courage, that it takes very little courage to sweep domestic violence under the rug. But when you sweep it under the rug, you know who's under that rug? Is the survivor. And so you're just funneling all of that responsibility to deal with that abuse and respond to that abuse back to the person who's being systematically disempowered and harmed by this batterer. And so to be able to say, I care about you, and I know that you may have good intentions with some of the things that you're saying, but the way that it's landing, you're hurting your family. And I don't want you to lose your family. Let's talk about how to do things differently. So not just a pushback kind of confrontation that's a one-off and walk away, but a walking next to that person and taking almost a coaching role with them is healthy and it's effective. It actually helps. And the last thing that I'll say about this is that if it doesn't, right, if you know that a survivor is consistently being abused, that you've tried to intervene with the batterer and nothing is helping, offer that survivor some help. Offer them Helpmate's hotline number, which again is 254-0516. Offer to drive them to the Family Justice Center. Tell them that you see what's happening and that you care about them. Because a lot of times batterers will gaslight a survivor and try to make them believe that it's really not that bad, that this really isn't abuse. This is just what a relationship should look like. And when you're isolated from your friends and family and the only voice in your ear is telling you this is normal, then it's easy to believe that that's true. And so having this outside voice that's able to say, I see this and I know that it's not okay, can be a really important thing. And the one caveat I'll give to all of that is consider your own personal safety. If you know that confronting this abusive partner means that they're going to escalate and they're going to get violent with you, then instead of doing those things, call the police for help, have that survivor call Helpmate for help, and help them work on an exit plan, right? Because we're not in the game of trying to get anybody else hurt.
I agree with you. But I can see a lot of people, both men and women, saying, where do I overstep? And I start to be intrusive. That's not my business. I don't know what's going on. And even if I think there's abuse, like I may observe something when a couple's out and go, that's weird, that's odd. But you don't really know until you see bruises. It's tough for folks, I think, to know whether and how to cross that line. And you've got to be really good friends with someone, I think, in a lot of cases, to start to get there, to be like, dude, something seems out of whack. You want to talk about it? I mean, it's just one of those. It doesn't come up naturally. You're not sitting there over a beer. I mean, it's just it's a challenge. How would you help people navigate that?
Sure. I think we're working against a few cultural norms, right? One is that your family business stays in the family, right? That cultural norm has spawned a lot of domestic violence over time. And so I think we have to push back on that a bit. The other is that we don't like as humans to feel awkward in a conversation. And so to be able to say, I hope that what you're saying was just out of character, was an offhand remark. I'm going to assume that the way you typically talk about your partner is X, Y, and Z, right? And so the other way that you can address that, if you don't have that in-depth relationship with that abusive person, is to make positive assumptions, right, and voice them. Because sometimes people will live up to the expectation that we set for them, right? So I know you've got the capacity to be kind. I know you've got the capacity to resolve conflicts peacefully. I know that you understand the boundary that they set. And I'm using some blunt terms, right? You know, when you offer that to a batterer, then one, you're building their confidence to do the right thing. And you're also letting them know what you believe the right thing is.
Thank you. I mean, this is, and I don't like pausing there or just stopping, but I think we do have to wrap up the show. And I want to say thank you, April, for joining us. What's been really helpful is to cover a lot of ground and help folks really understand this issue. And you provided some concrete actions for us on a daily basis. It's a real challenge for just what you said. I'm thinking in my head, how would I talk to a friend about this? Or because it takes a lot. It does take a lot of courage, but also you don't really know. And I do also think that there are some cultural things. Guys are going to be guys, and then you roll your eyes, and then it's like then it gets to be too late. And I think that's a challenge. And I think that there's a lot of reasons. I'm not a woman, obviously, where women stay for, you know, the wrong reasons as well. And it's just really unfortunate. You've brought a lot of insight, I think, to folks, and I really appreciate your time. But we have to go. Thanks, everybody, for joining. And Dreamers and Doers with Carol Anders is next. Stick around. Have a good one. 420 day.